Welcome to In Conversation by Medical News Today, the podcast that provides accurate, accessible information based on the latest medical research to empower you to make the best possible decisions on your health journey.
Weight loss, improved blood sugar, lower blood pressure, reduce cholesterol. These are just some of the purported benefits of intermittent fasting, at least in the short term. But what about its effects in the long run? Could intermittent fasting do more harm than good? I'm Yasemin Nicola-Sakai.
And I'm Maria Kohut.
In today's episode, we're exploring the topic of intermittent fasting, what it is and how it can benefit or harm health, to whom it might not be right for. Joining us is Dr. Ali Javaheri, Assistant Professor of Medicine from the Center for Cardiovascular Research at Washington University. He'll help us shed light on how fasting affects our organs, especially the heart, in light of a recent viral study that suggested that 16 hours of fasting could increase the risk of cardiovascular disease by 91%.
Yaz, tell me, have you ever tried intermittent fasting or any other form of time-restricted eating?
Well, unknowingly, in my uni days, especially during busy periods, I have quote-unquote intermittently fasted. But last year, I actually tried 14-10 fasting for about 6 weeks. I didn't really do it to help improve my blood sugar or blood pressure. It was more so to see if it helped with inflammation. Right now, I'd say I'm still following a similar pattern, maybe with a longer eating window most days, but I do tend to intuitively eat, so I like to listen to my body. What about you, Maria?
I haven't tried it at all, but I think we both know somebody who has. So Francesca Taylor, who's our producer, in the background with us here. Frankie, have you tried it?
I have, actually. I don't eat before 1 p.m. And the main reason I started doing it was because my stomach would just get so loud in work meetings. It would hit about 11 and there was just no concealing it. It would just be like the loudest thing in the room and I'd be ravenous. And this was even if I'd had a banana for breakfast or something. So it really worked. And because I'm not ravenous, I think I have in turn become more conscious about the window and therefore my choices for lunch as well.
Very interesting. That's great to know. Thank you for the perspective. Shall we dive into the topic with our expert, with Professor Ali Javaheri, to see if we should be worried about this latest study that everybody's been banging on about?
Yes. Hi, Ali. Thank you for joining us on In Conversation today.
Hi, great to be with you. I'm Ali Javaheri. I'm an assistant professor at Washington University in St. Louis and also John Cochrane VA, where I see patients who have mostly heart failure. I'm a heart failure transplant cardiologist, and I run a basic and translational and clinical research program that focuses on cardiometabolic disease and fasting. So that's one of the more major interests is intermittent fasting.
Okay, well, fantastic. Let's dive in.
Great.
Excellent. Thank you. Can we just start with looking at what intermittent fasting is and maybe very briefly talk about the different forms of intermittent fasting?
Sure. Intermittent fasting means a lot of different things to different people. And as you point out, there's different forms of intermittent fasting. And so very broadly, fasting could include periods of abstinence from food alternating with periods where food is not restricted. One type of intermittent fasting, for example, that we study is actually alternate day fasting, where there's alternating cycles of food restriction. In our studies, actually basically water-only fasting with days of ad libitum or ad lib feeding, where there's no restriction on food. So that's kind of, you know, one extreme example. And there's iterations of that where the things that can be varied are the number of fasting days per week or per month. So in one other common type of intermittent fasting called 5-2, there's 7 days in a week, There's 5 days of regular eating and 2 days of fasting. Now, the other thing that you can change is what fasting is. So fasting in a lot of studies means that you're going to consume some calories, but not as many as you normally do. And that might be maybe 25% or less of total calories on the fasting days. So there's different forms of intermittent fasting in terms of the amount of food restriction and the days of food restriction. There's also another wholly different type of intermittent fasting called time-restricted eating, or TRE. And this is also popular. And what this is basically just restricting the hours where you eat during the day. And that can be accomplished by just eating only during a certain time window, which could be, you know, more restrictive or less restrictive. And in most studies where this is done, the total calories are also restricted. So it can be pretty complicated because there's so many different iterations of these different dietary interventions. But in general, you know, so there's intermittent fasting, and that encompasses time-restricted eating as well as actual fasting on whole days, and those things, different variables can be changed to come up with different dietary protocols.
Hi, we're thrilled that you're listening to In Conversation by Medical News Today. Our aim is to give you accessible and actionable advice to improve your health. To stay up to date on the latest conversations and debates around medical research, hit the follow button now. You'll help us reach more people who may need this important research. Okay, back to the episode. I think that was a good introduction, and I think maybe we should move on to the benefits of intermittent fasting. So we've got a lot of evidence around its benefits, such as improved insulin resistance and lowered inflammation, especially in people with type 2 diabetes or obesity. And one key benefit, and perhaps the most popular, is weight loss. So, Ali, does intermittent fasting actually lead to weight loss?
How do I even start? The holy grail, like everybody sort of knows who studies nutrition and diet, that we all can respond differently to different interventions. But yet, what everybody wants is a diet that works for everybody. The reality is, any given diet works for somebody. So it depends what you're doing before. So in terms of actual practical advice, you know, to give patients, you are going to find people who swear by their intermittent fasting protocol that they've managed to lose weight, etc. But in terms of human studies that actually show that intermittent fasting is superior to another dietary strategy in terms of like hard clinical endpoints, doesn't exist. Now, there's a lot of, you know, variables, and we do a lot of studies also in mice, right? In animals, on the other hand, it is incredibly clear that consuming a lower amount of calories can have an enormous number of health benefits, including and not limited to lifespan extension. Can it make you live longer? And this is true all the way down to like worm. If we give worms less food, or if we mutate worms so that the worms can't eat as much, they live longer. And so that's generated an enormous amount of interest in caloric restriction and fasting, as you can imagine. And really the holy grail here is not only just extending lifespan, but extending health span. Is that possible? And the answer is yes. In animals, in, you know, for sure, definitely in rodents, you can improve their health span by fasting them. You could actually make them more robust as they age with these kinds of fasting strategies. Walter Longo, who's at University of Southern California and wrote the famous book, The Longevity Diet, their group actually published a paper in Cell, which came out probably, I don't know, maybe it was a month or two before our paper, using something called a fasting mimicking diet that I didn't mention before. It's actually very interesting. And what that is it's a diet that it's, you know, proprietary. You can buy it from their company. And I'm in no way affiliated with them. I just wanted to put that out. But it's very interesting. It's basically a 5-day pre-specified diet that you follow.
So for those listening, a fasting mimicking diet is a low-calorie diet with a specific macro and micronutrient content profile that people follow for 5 days, and it's supposed to trick the body to enter into fasting mode, basically.
So the fasting mimicking diet, in terms of these fasting studies, I just wanted to say, has some of the best human data.
So to sum up, a lot of these studies then are actually in animals, and a lot of the data that we have about restricted eating and intermittent fasting in general as it relates to weight loss comes from these animal studies, which unclear whether or not the same findings would apply to humans, correct? And the best data, you said, comes about the fasting mimicking diet, which is slightly different.
I don't know that there's really data that supports that intermittent fasting strategies for weight loss are better than other kind of healthy diets. Like, is it better than the Mediterranean diet? The effects of fasting, even just acute fasting, involves activation of a bunch of pathways. And we should talk about that, right? And so one of them that's very famous is called autophagy. Auto is for self, phagy is for eating. So this is a regenerative process whereby the cells in our body are able to recycle the various damaged components of the cell. So if you imagine it's like recycling, right? That's the recycling if it worked well, right? Where we actually are able to, instead of just, you know, wasting trash, essentially, could we actually use the things that we're breaking down to make new things, right? And so that's the idea, is that fasting induces that pathway, leads to sort of a regeneration, and that would be sort of the fountain of youth, right? So that's the idea. And so the concept is that there could be benefits to fasting that are actually out of proportion to weight loss. That would be the holy grail, right? Is that we actually get these health benefits, these cardiometabolic effects, this anti-aging effect, even before we lose weight.
I think most people think intermittent fasting's benefits come from weight loss, like solely from weight loss. But you said that there are other mechanisms at play that play into this. Is that correct?
So, you know, a lot of people that start fasting will notice that they do lose weight. Are the benefits just via weight loss? I don't think so. I mean, this question that you're asking is a really profound and important question that's also become, it's really come to the forefront, not just because of fasting, but also, and I don't want to get off topic, but because of these, you know, injectable weight loss drugs, these GLP-1 agonists with one of these drugs. And, you know, 2 weeks ago at the American College of Cardiology, new data in diabetic patients with a certain type of heart failure emerged that these drugs are really effective. And so it's the same question. Is it via weight loss or is it via something else? I think if you're having success with one of these strategies, you know, if it's fasting, if you're someone who has heart failure of a certain type or diabetes or whatever, and you're having success, that's great. The exact mechanisms probably don't matter to you because it depends on what you were doing before and it depends on what we're comparing it to, right? And if we're comparing two diets that are both really, really, really healthy and we have problems of people actually adhering to those diets, people are going to benefit from these healthier diets compared to what they were doing before. And then telling the difference, the relative difference between these diets is going to be tough. So a big factor is just implementation of what we can really stick with.
I'm also glad that you brought into discussion GLP-1 agonists. Our previous podcast episode was on GLP-1 agonists and weight loss plateau. So this is a really nice sort of continuation of that. But you also brought up the cardiovascular benefits, and I'm glad you did that because, again, with intermittent fasting practices, there is some evidence to suggest that there are some cardiovascular benefits, including helping to regulate blood pressure and helping to regulate resting heart rate, which is great. However, and this brings us to
why I'm here, I guess.
This
yeah.
brings us to today's main topic, I guess. Yes, as we are aware, there is a recent study that was presented at a conference called EPI Lifestyle Scientific Sessions 2024 in Chicago. And this study made headlines by suggesting that one of the most common, most popular types of restricted eating, rather, so the 16-8 where there is an 8-hour period where people eat, and then there's 16 hours that they fast for. So that's quite a long time to fast. So they were suggesting that this eating within an 8-hour time window type of dietary pattern could increase the risk of cardiovascular death by as much as 91%, which is quite a shocking percentage.
Yeah.
I don't want to start immediately with the negatives. I want to start by looking at the pros, the benefits to cardiovascular health that restricted eating might bring. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so again, I'd lean heavily on animal data here. And, you know, what we know is that fasting, acute fasting, triggers this process called autophagy, which, like I mentioned, is this self-renewal process. And what are the tangible sort of benefits of that in animal models? So lifespan extension, health span extension, improved handling of glucose.
Which is blood sugar.
Yes, blood sugar. Thank you. Reduced fat mass, improved lean mass. And in some animal models, even heart failure, improved survival and improvements in actual heart function. And then there's some human studies where people, for example, with high blood pressure were put on sort of acute fasts and their blood pressure dramatically improved and things of that sort. And we've written about, you know, summaries of those kinds of studies. And the problem with those studies is often the lack of controls. You know, I'm not trying to poo-poo any of this stuff, but I think that these studies are just really hard to do. They're really hard to do. And oftentimes people were compared to themselves beforehand, or maybe what are called biomarkers. So like blood tests. So blood tests definitely improve compared to before. And that's super clear. But does that translate into tangible health benefits as compared to another healthy diet? And I keep parroting that. And the answer is like, we don't really know.
So when it comes to this study, why do you think that they observed this really significant adverse effect? That's quite shocking if you look at this number as it appears in the headlines.
Look, I've spoken a lot about sort of the health benefits, especially in animals. And I think that for me, this poster that's been circulated, this abstract that's been circulated, it's interesting that it's generated so much attention. It's because of this number, I think, is 91%. But before this happened, our lab actually had a paper that came out a year ago about toxicity of intermittent fasting in animals. And actually another lab had a letter in a journal called Circulation on time-restricted feeding and atherosclerosis. So I just wanted to say up front that really, in order to figure out sort of causality, we're really dependent on these sorts of animal studies that are mostly performed in mice in order to learn mechanisms. And we could get more into that, but your question was about the poster. And so the problem with studies that aren't randomized and studies that are basically just assessing associations is that it's really difficult to differentiate or infer a causal association, like A leads to B versus a correlation. A and B happen together. So a really good example of this, I think, would illustrate the point. So like on a hot day, people might go out in the sun and get hot and buy ice cream. People might also get a sunburn. So if you were to look at a correlation, you might find that people who bought ice cream got a sunburn. But we all know it wasn't because they actually bought the ice cream that they got the sunburn. It was the sun, right? The sun caused both these things. And that's an example of correlation that's not probably causation. So could that same thing have happened here, right? And so the big, big thing, and we try to adjust for these different factors that we call them confounders. We try to adjust for them in these types of analyses that are associations. So what did these people do? This group of scientists and doctors looked at a National Health and Nutrition Exam survey between 2003 and 2018. And then they looked at a national death index through December of 2019. And then what they did is they were able to associate the eating duration on the survey with the all-cause death, cardiovascular death, and cancer death outcomes that these people had over this period of time. And it was, you know, a large number of people, like almost 44,000 people. So that's a good number of people. But I want to say that the number of people that were actually in the smallest time window was like 400 people. right? So that's, what is that? 1% of the, about 1%, 44,400. So that's number one. So it's a small number of people. Number two is you try to adjust for differences between the people. And one of the differences, what was unique about the 400 people, more of them smoked.
Yeah, that's one of those confounding factors, right, that we were talking about earlier. And just to very briefly interject an explanation of what confounding factors are, these are lifestyle factors or other factors that could actually play a role in the development of a particular health problem, right?
Yeah. So the biggest confounder here that I worry about is people who fast for less than 8 hours a day might be doing it for some reason. Like, they're really worried about their health. Who knows why? It's some other reason, right? They have a really strong family history, or they've got, you know, they're starting to gain weight. And even though they might not be obese, maybe that, you know, right? Or something, right? They were diagnosed with something we don't know about. And so these kinds of studies, these association studies, are just really challenging. They're even more challenging than the randomized studies in humans. Right. And so we have to use sort of, you know, common sense to interpret these types of studies. And so I guess the summary of this is, when you think about the increased smoking, the really restrictive time window, the small sample size in that group, I really would question whether there's really a 91% increase.
In essence, you're telling everyone, hey, don't panic about the findings.
Yeah, definitely don't panic. And I think the central message, if you're going to take one thing home from this conversation, diets are individual. Don't stick to some restrictive diet that's crushing your soul because of some purported health benefit that you believe in. Look at your own life and ask yourself, is this working for me? And is this something I can really sustain, right? Because what we definitely know about diets is that they don't work well if they're short-term, temporary things. And I think that a lot of us who sort of take care of patients for a living have really come to appreciate that really short-term diets have a lot of negative consequences for people.
Is it actually safe for everyone? That's a big question I think we should be addressing.
Absolutely. But if you survey people and you find people doing something really restrictive, right, at a certain time, and then you don't know, did they follow up with it? The question is, are there negative health effects, if you observe them, due to what they were actually doing at that time, or due to what happened if they stopped?
Yes, there is a lack of long-term studies on intermittent fasting. That is one of the biggest concerns, I think.
So absolutely. So is intermittent fasting safe? Yeah, almost certainly it is. But the question is yo-yo dieting safe? And in reality, for a lot of people, different dietary strategies, what you're really studying is yo-yo dieting.
Okay.
And that's why we're so reliant on good randomized trials and common sense and animal studies to try to sort of really understand the mechanisms and what might be happening.
Okay. So I get the sense that you would more likely recommend, as an expert, as a expert in cardiology, that people follow more manageable dietary styles or approaches that they can incorporate into their daily lives and isn't as strict or quite intense as intermittent fasting. Would that be correct?
You're 100% right. Absolutely. I have sort of like five basic rules that I tell patients that if they follow, they're going to be healthier. Don't eat too much. Don't eat super late at night. Eat more vegetables, more green things. Avoid sugary drinks and processed food, and decrease alcohol.
Okay. So those are the five rules that our readers, our listeners need to take away?
Yeah. I mean, if you incorporate those five things into your life, whatever you're doing today, you're going to be healthier for the most part.
So I have one last little question. If people want to practice intermittent fasting, what would you recommend? What should people watch out for or be concerned about if they want to do this?
So it's a great question. So what we found was that in a model of muscle loss, that sustained fasting, meaning sustained alternate day fasting, was toxic. And so I would say that, you know, dose probably matters. So if what you're worried about is frailty and muscle loss and, you know, osteoporosis, unfortunately, some people are going to have a hip fracture. Let's say somebody is overweight or whatever, and they want to get health benefits from a fasting strategy. I would recommend something like a fasting mimicking diet. So you could, if you can afford it, it's kind of expensive. The fasting mimicking diet is something you do for a few days once a month. But then there's different sort of variations of things. So an intermittent fasting strategy could get you the benefits of fasting without sort of the, what I worry about is for people who are on a really strict regimen, that what happens if they stop, right? Whereas the body's a lot less likely to, I think, accommodate to something that you do for a few days once a month than it is to something that you do every other day.
And one more thing, would I be right in saying people would benefit from talking with a medical provider, a health professional, before they attempted to engage in such eating dietary practices?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much. Thank you so, so much. This has been an amazing discussion.
Yes, Maria, thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. For more information on the study we mentioned on intermittent fasting, you can find a link to the article in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to be notified when the next episode is out, make sure to hit that follow button now. I've been Yasmin Nicola-Sakai.
And I've been Maria Kohut. And this has been In Conversation by Medical News Today.